Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Kate, and I too would like to welcome everyone. Today's Cancer Connect workshop, and today's program is Understanding Diagnostic Technologies and Targeted Therapies. And you're going to hear all about these concepts and these treatments. So at the end of this call, you'll be much more informed about these diagnostic tests. And today is part one of a two-part series on informed decision-making and personalized care. So you're going to hear more about that as well. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of our collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, there are 617 people on the call today, so a lot of you on the call today from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Australia, Brazil, Canada, Croatia, Egypt, Ireland, Micronesia, Netherlands, Sri Lanka, and the United Kingdom. So really from all over the world. And it's really, we are delighted with your participation on this program today. This is a very important, these are very important concepts and ideas that you're going to be hearing about today in terms of treatments and how it affects your treatment. It's very important. And today's program was made possible by Abbott Molecular, an independent educational grant from Merck & Company. Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today. I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Mark Chris. And Dr. Chris is attending physician, Thoracic Oncology Service, the William and Joy Rain Chair in Thoracic Oncology, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Chris is going to present an overview of diagnostic and prognostic technologies and how they inform treatment decisions for people living with lung cancer. And each of our speakers are going to talk about a specific type of cancer, and so they'll help you to better understand how your treatments are determined. Dr. Chris?
All right. Thank you, Carolyn. And again, thank you, Cancer Care, for making this possible. I don't think you can see any sort of publication about cancer care and not hear these terms, the term personalized medicine or targeted therapies. And what we're hoping to do in the next 2 hours, you know, this session and the one on October 10th, would be to talk about some of the technologies and talk about how specific information that can be made available to your doctor shared with you can be used to help make better treatment decisions for your fight against your cancer. It's a tough topic, and I guess a couple of things at the start. The first is it's a rapidly evolving field. Our knowledge of biology grows day by day. Our technology grows and ability to get biological information from a person's tumor sample. And the kinds of information we're getting today are not what you learned when you were in school, and I'll use me as an example. My joke is they didn't have DNA when I was in medical school. Actually, they did, but the things we can do with DNA now far exceed anything that I ever knew. And I'm learning, and all of us are learning, along the way. The second thing is technology is advancing so quickly, more targets being found, more drugs for those targets being approved. It literally changes month to month. So it's a very hopeful sign that we are making progress here and that everyone will have more options to fight their cancers. But it is a work in progress, and things may change, so I have to ask you to live with even a little more uncertainty as to what kind of tests will be done, what tests will be done, by what method, and how that's going to help you. Just want to take a little step back first as to, you know, how do you diagnose cancer? That is really the first step in your care, and the diagnosis of cancer is still based on a pathologic evaluation. With extraordinarily rare exceptions, cancer can always be diagnosed through the examination of a piece of tissue from your body, from the cancer cells that they've been able to remove. And a pathologist looks at that under the microscope and makes a diagnosis of cancer. So I think that's one important fact. Cancer can only be diagnosed that way. There is no scan that can diagnose cancer. There is no blood test that can diagnose cancer, only a pathologic review of some material that came from your body. The second thing in fighting cancer is knowing where it started, and doctors will spend time determining that. And they do a bunch of tests to do that. They do a CAT scan and MRIs, which are basically photographs or pictures of your body. They do a PET scan, which actually looks at the function of various body tissues. They can give you the suggestion that cancer's there, but only a pathologic specimen can lead to that diagnosis. When these pathologic specimens are obtained, in addition to the pathologist looking under the microscope, telling you what that there is cancer there based on its appearance, telling you the likely origin of that cancer based on the visual examination and additional test. What pathologists do nowadays is they take that specimen and extract from it the DNA and RNA. Again, the DNA and RNA, DNA is our kind of hard drive. It's our template. It's where are the code that builds all of our body's tissues are there. And the way that that code gets translated into proteins is through the RNA. And the RNA then goes to other structures within the cell and ultimately makes proteins. Proteins do the work of the body. So heart proteins make your heart work. Liver proteins make your liver work. Kidney proteins make your liver work. So the main thing that folks analyze for in the DNA is changes in the DNA from the normal. They can see where pieces of the DNA were damaged or are different from normal DNA. They call them mutations. Sometimes two pieces of the DNA aren't changed, but they're rearranged, or pieces of them can be lost. And all those things can be associated with certain kinds of cancers and treatments. And probably the best example of that would be first in like chronic myelogenous leukemia, a mutation in the c-KIT gene leads rise to an abnormal effectiveness of a protein called Abelson kinase, and that can be inhibited by the drug imatinib or Gleevec, and that's probably one of the strongest examples for that. There's another way to look at DNA. Sometimes you get multiple copies made of the DNA, and that can also be something that can be underlie a certain cancer. That's called amplification. It can be a FISH test, and I think we're going to hear more about probably our most famous FISH test, and that's the one for HER2, which is extremely important in breast cancer, also important in gastric cancers and a growing number of cancers as well, including lung. RNA, probably the most important test there is Oncotype, and I think we'll be hearing from Dr. Ruddy about the role of the Oncotype test, which is a little different, actually. It doesn't identify a target for which you give a targeted drug, but it very potently, for certain groups of patients, identifies those that need post-operative therapy for their breast cancer. And lastly, there are proteins, and breast cancer is the perfect example of that. Virtually every breast cancer is looked at for estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, HER2 protein, and again, I think Dr. Ruddy will explain, you know, how that works. For lung cancer, this testing is a standard of care. If you go to our standard treatment guidelines, they recommend testing every tumor specimen for the presence of genetic changes, using those genetic changes to help decide treatment and to select specific drugs based on those changes. To add to the confusion here, as we go through, try to remember that different alterations can occur in different cancer types. So the EGFR mutation, very common in lung cancer, really never seen in other cancer types. Conversely, there are other kinds of genetic changes that where different cancer types have the same alteration. And a good example there would be the BRAF, V600E mutation in melanoma. It almost guarantees sensitivity to a drug called vemurafenib or dabrafenib. In lung cancer, probably the same. But in colorectal cancer, a BRAF mutation does not mean sensitivity to those drugs, and you'll hear Dr. Benson talking about that. My time is short, and I just want to end on a few things. The first is the importance of these tests. They really need to be done because they truly guide therapy and lead to therapies that are likely to be much more effective and to have fewer side effects. So I think one of the biggest issues for patients is the waiting time in the obtaining of specimens and getting these test results. And that's something very important that you need to discuss with your doctor. And your doctor has to explain to you, is the time necessary to get this result justified? I know once the cancer diagnosis is made, people deservedly you need to get started on treatment. The second is, with rare exception now, we still need tissue for these tests, and that means a biopsy of some kind. It can be through a surgery, it can be through a bronchoscopy, it can be through an interventional procedure, a biopsy through the skin, but you need those biopsies. And lastly, and I'll end on this again, this is a tremendously changing landscape. The tests are getting so much more comprehensive, so much more precise, so much cheaper day by day, and individual hospitals are constantly upgrading the kind of testing and they can do. Also, more and more tumors are being tested for these drivers. And with that, I will end and turn now to Dr. Benson, who's going to talk about the specific genetic alterations and determinants of treatments for colon cancers.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Chris. That was an excellent introduction to the whole program and also focus on lung cancer as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Benson. And Dr. Benson is a professor of medicine, associate director for clinical investigations, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center of Northwestern University. And Dr. Benson is going to talk about how these technologies contribute to treatment choices, and he's going to focus on novel targeted treatments for people living with colon cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Benson.
Thank you, Dr. Mesner. It's a pleasure to join everyone today. To build upon what Dr. Chris just said, the science of oncology has never been more exciting. And with these developments, we believe we can offer much more precision in terms of the treatments we offer people. And the promise for the future for cancer patients, I think, is wonderful because of these developments and the science that is emerging. In essence, what we're doing now with tissue is to identify particular genes, as mentioned by Dr. Chris, and biologic pathways that are important in terms of the growth of cancers and also can lead to resistance of treatments. So there's a great deal of study, and also the whole field of drug development is focused on identifying these particular features within tumors that would enable drugs to better halt or halt a tumor growth or actually destroy a tumor cell. Most of the biologic treatments that are being developed and linked to these particular genes or biological pathways are actually not destroying cancer cells, but keeping them stable and helping to prevent growth, which for many people is a critical development. There are challenges, however, in that tumors can change over time. So as tumors grow and as they spread, for example, to other organs, a process we refer to as metastases, the genetic structure within the tumor can actually change. It can evolve, and there can be new and different, for example, mutations that were not present initially when the tumor was diagnosed. And so this creates a challenge in terms of For example, do we have to do multiple biopsies of tumors over time to identify genetic changes that may benefit from a totally different approach than was originally taken? And this is a concept that's evolving, and it's certainly being incorporated in clinical trials that are looking at these specific changes within tumors and identifying drugs that we hope will address these specific changes and lead to better outcomes. And most of these trials do require that we obtain tissue so that we can have a very up-to-date understanding of the what's happening with the tumor and identifying appropriate targeted drugs. Now, there are a number of diagnostic companies that are developing what we sometimes refer to as platforms, which give information about the genetic composition of tumors, and we're actually using this information to link people now to particular clinical trials with drugs in development. And this is happening around the country and represents a really big change in not only how we conduct cancer clinical trials, but actually how we are treating our patients. Sometimes these tests may be done at your local hospital, but often the tissue must be sent to a reference laboratory or diagnostic company for processing. And as Dr. Chris mentioned, this can lead to some delay, even 2 to 3 weeks before we have the information to make a decision. Now, often you'll hear these tests referred to as markers, but the principle is the same. These are identifying markers which we hope to link to a particular treatment. There are both prognostic markers, and prognostic markers tell us something about what is the projected outcome for an individual patient in terms of how long they might survive their cancer or whether they have a great chance for cure. There are also predictive markers, and these are of tremendous interest because with predictive markers, we hope to identify a given treatment based on a given tumor marker that will predictably result in benefit for the patient who receives a given treatment. Now, in colon cancer, we have made some progress, but we do have a great deal more work to do. We have identified some important markers. Dr. Chris mentioned the BRAF mutation, which is seen in other cancers such as melanoma. In colon cancer, this mutation is not seen as frequently as it might be seen in other cancers, occurring in less than 10% of all those with colon cancer. Currently, we cannot use the marker to identify a particular treatment for an individual. However, having said that, there are now clinical trials that are attempting to do this, and we hope these trials will eventually give us drugs that will benefit people with a BRAF mutation. It is a prognostic marker, and unfortunately, those individuals who have the BRAF mutation tend to have a poorer prognosis. And this information can be critical because it can help guide the discussion and the treatment choices that we have for an individual person. There is also another mutation that has been of great interest called the KRAS mutation, and now we actually are testing beyond just KRAS, but other RAS mutations, which are critical predictive markers. So if a person has what we refer to as wild-type RAS. That individual has a chance to benefit from two different targeted therapies, one referred to as cetuximab, the other is panitumumab. If, however, an individual has a mutation in RAS, then that individual will not benefit from either cetuximab or panitumumab. These are treatments used for individuals with metastatic colorectal cancer, and therefore these mutation analyses should be done as soon as an individual is diagnosed with metastatic disease, because it will help determine what treatment options may be available over time. This concept is referred to as the continuum of care for patients with colorectal cancer and reflects not only better understanding of the biology of an individual person's colorectal cancer, but also what treatment options, and there are many now, for the individual over time. Finally, there's another type of genetic analysis called microsatellite instability. And this is seen in about 15% of all colorectal cancer patients and is also linked in a much smaller group of individuals with an inherited type of colon cancer referred to as the Lynch syndrome. Those individuals with microsatellite instability tumors have a very, very good prognosis. And in fact, for those individuals with stage 2 colon cancer, if they have an MSI tumor, that individual has such a good prognosis that for the majority of people, we do not recommend chemotherapy after surgery. So it's an important piece of information. And also under development, and there are now some commercial companies, are what we refer to as gene profiles, which in colon cancer are now prognostic, and they can help guide, particularly for stage 2 patients, what might be the risk of recurrence. Unfortunately, these so-called recurrence scores are not predictive. So even if we tell an individual they might be at higher risk to develop a recurrence of their colon cancer, we cannot tell them yet that they will benefit from a particular therapeutic intervention. And this is certainly an area of research and more clinical trials that are directed to answer these type of questions. That was just a very quick summary of some of the advances in colon cancer. We are in the process of designing more clinical trials that will link specific tumor markers with new drugs that target those markers. And so we expect in a very short time some large studies available to people in the United States to better link tumor characteristics with particular treatments. Thanks for your attention.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Benson. That was wonderful and very informative. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Catherine Ruddy. Dr. Ruddy is Director, Cancer Survivorship, Department of Oncology, Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Ruddy is going to address technologies predicting response to treatment for people living with breast cancer and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Ruddy.
Thank you so much for inviting me to participate in this call. Dr. Chris mentioned that the estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and the HER2-new protein are important for treatment decisions in breast cancer. And so I'll just discuss this in a little greater detail. All three of these proteins can be assessed by a test called immunohistochemistry, which involves staining tissue to detect whether or not the important proteins are present in a biopsy or a surgical tissue specimen. When the hormone receptors are expressed, we know that anti-estrogen treatments will be effective against the breast cancer, while when these hormone receptors are not expressed, we know the tumor will not respond to anti-estrogen treatments. And this is a very, very important and very effective therapy for patients whose tumors do express these receptors. For the HER2 new protein, things are a little bit more complex. Sometimes the immunohistochemistry is definitive and we can tell whether or not the protein is expressed, but sometimes we need an additional test called FISH. Dr. Chris also mentioned this test. This is fluorescence in situ hybridization. And it's really a test that lets us see whether a specific gene or a portion of a gene is overexpressed in a cancer. In breast cancer, when we do FISH testing for this HER2 new gene, we're able to tell whether the gene is overexpressed and therefore whether the cancer will respond to our anti-HER2 new treatments such as trastuzumab and pertuzumab and other drugs. Actually, we've had very effective drug development for patients with HER2 new positive breast cancers, and so it's very important that we figure out which these tumors are and that we really do HER2 new testing as well as estrogen and progesterone receptor testing on all breast cancers to make sure we're treating these as effectively as we can be. In breast cancer care, one of the major dilemmas we face in treatment is how to weigh the benefits and risks of chemotherapy. Because we really do cure many patients with surgery, with or without radiation, and with anti-estrogen treatments, we don't always need chemotherapy, and it's sometimes difficult to decide who would also benefit from chemotherapy on top of these other treatments to reduce their risk of recurrence further. We balance the degree of reduction in risk of recurrence from the chemotherapy against the risks of the chemotherapy, such as the acute side effects, the long-term side effects, the risk of infertility for some patients, and the clear interference with work and family responsibilities that chemotherapy brings. We know that we have to really take these seriously, and side effects from chemotherapy can include not only things like nausea and hair loss and fatigue, but also things that could be longer lasting, like cardiac damage, and even in rare cases, we can cause long-lasting nerve damage and other problems. And so we certainly don't want to give chemotherapy to anyone who doesn't need it. And so I'm going to talk now about two technologies that help us make this chemotherapy decision. And these are very important to me as a medical oncologist when I'm making sure that I am giving chemotherapy only to patients who will get substantial benefit from it. One of these tools is called Adjuvant Online. And this is really a web-based technology that allows us to put a patient's characteristics and also characteristics of a tumor into an online calculator that allows us to estimate how much benefit a patient will get from anti-estrogen treatments and also from chemotherapy. And I really do find that this is quite helpful in informing our decision-making in the clinic. And the second tool I wanted to mention is called Oncotype DX. And this test actually is on the tumor specimen itself. The Oncotype DX technology is a genetic test on the tumor, and it's specifically developed for tumors that are estrogen sensitive and that do not overexpress the HER2 new protein. So this is the group of tumors for which we have the most indecision about whether or not there's benefit from chemotherapy, because these tend to act less aggressively, and often we can treat these very effectively without chemotherapy. So what the Oncotype DX test does is evaluate 21 genes in these tumors to estimate the chance that the cancer will come back with anti-estrogen treatment alone, and then how much lower we can get that by giving chemotherapy in addition. And this can be very, very helpful when we're uncertain about whether chemotherapy is warranted for an early stage breast cancer that is estrogen sensitive and does not overexpress the HER2 new protein. Another important technology to mention as a predictor of treatment response for breast cancer is breast imaging. We're treating more and more breast cancer patients with chemotherapy or anti-estrogen treatment before surgery to shrink tumors before they're operated on. And so it's very important that we be able to assess as accurately as possible the extent of the disease after the chemotherapy or anti-estrogen treatment so that the best surgery can be planned. For some patients, breast MRI can play a really critical role here for evaluation before a surgery. And finally, I'll talk briefly about technologies that may be useful for monitoring and managing symptoms and improving quality of life in cancer patients. We all recognize that cancer and its treatments can impact a person's physical, social, and emotional quality of life. it's important that healthcare providers regularly assess cancer patients' symptoms so that they can provide suggestions for ways to help them feel better. There's a lot of interest in mobile applications and web-based tools that allow patients to report symptoms from home and communicate remotely with healthcare providers. Many patients live hundreds of miles away from their oncologists, so it's really critical that we develop ways to spare patients long-distance travel while still managing symptoms and optimizing quality of life. Ideally, we'll have apps that allow patients to easily log symptoms in real time and allow nurses or other providers to offer suggestions about how to optimize quality of life and manage treatment complications. With that, I will finish, and I'll be happy to take questions in the second half of this call.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Ruddy. That was really excellent. And thank you for also introducing the concept of mobile apps so people can actually get help with things long distance. It's really wonderful, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. Dr. Morrow is leader, Myeloproliferative Diseases Program, member, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. Morrow is going to be addressing personalized care for people living with hematologic cancers and communicating with the healthcare team about clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Morrow.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you all for joining, and it's a pleasure to be with you today. So you've heard a fantastic introduction, but Dr. Chris and Drs. Benson and Ruddy have really covered a lot of how targeted therapy and the technologies around it and have driven a lot of different changes to diagnostics, therapeutics, monitoring, a number of different things. And my turn is to speak about hematologic cancers. I've had the pleasure of working in the field of myeloproliferative disorders and CML, where we really, I think, have been lucky enough to have a disease that was perhaps ideal for targeted therapies, and have built a good story of how understanding diagnostic techniques and developing targeted therapies really can work. So in the hematologic malignancies, quite a revolution has taken place, and I think we're moving further and further away from historic ways we would think about cancer. We would, you know, we traditionally diagnose cancer at a clinical level when someone has symptoms or problems, and we look by imaging, by exam, by biopsying, multiple different modalities, what clinically is apparent. We then often have tissue specimens that go to pathology, and we look at things under the microscope. These are, you know, all things that have been mentioned previously and are quite useful, but clearly at the molecular level, we've can learn so much more. And CML was a disease really that was characterized molecularly. So if a cancer of any type can be understood at the molecular or the mechanistic level. In this case, CML set the example of where molecular characterization of a disease led to derived therapy or the design of therapy based on a molecular abnormality. And honestly, that may not always work, and that wasn't known to be the solution for CML until we tried it. But clearly, we have been able to blaze a trail that targeted therapy is effective. CML was not the first disease, really HER2 and breast cancer, and even anti-estrogen therapy for breast cancer was the first targeted therapy. But we've seen an explosion based on this concept of molecularly derived therapy as based in the root cause of a disease and how effective that can be, and actually how that can help us understand resistance, because resistance after molecular therapy can be much more specific than it may be in general, or we know maybe what to look for, and that actually can help us derive other therapies, and that has been the case in CML as well. But in other blood cancers, we've learned, I think, quite a bit, and the CML example has driven many different advances, and I'll just touch on a few of the other hematologic cancers as well. I think AML is another example where we have historically seen this as one disease of many perhaps clinical and pathological, or one disease clinically with many different pathologic types where someone might have a certain subtype of AML. And there certainly were a lot of fine-tuning in AML that has taken place over the past few decades with genetic testing, chromosome testing, telling us which types of leukemias respond to certain therapies and which are pose a greater risk or relapse and may need stem cell transplant as their final therapy or may respond to chemotherapy. But AML has been sort of turned on its head and is being characterized at a molecular level. And I think we definitely are seeing emergence of new pathways that may be common to multiple types of AML and root causes or drivers, we call them driver mutations, and that term's been mentioned before. I believe Dr. Chris or others have used the same term. And that really maybe how we can recharacterize AML and not describe it based on its pathology or the chromosomes that are abnormal in cells, but what switches have been thrown at the cellular level, and how can we target those? One example might be something called IDH, which is a simple enzyme, and it's quite basic to the function of a cell, but if it's abnormal, there are inhibitors of IDH1 and IDH2, which are mutations in AML, and a therapeutic trial that's shown great advance and might be a broad treatment for sometimes difficult-to-treat AML cases based on an entirely molecular characterization rather than a pathologic or cytogenetic classification. CLL is another example where we've had tremendous advances in the last few years targeting therapies in the B-cell receptor pathway, particularly with targeting the PI3 kinase pathway with a drug called idelalisib, and also the Bruton tyrosine kinase pathway with a drug called ibrutinib. While they're hard to pronounce, these drugs are extremely effective and really have revolutionized the treatment of CLL, posing lower risk to patients and also being able to treat patients who have very high-risk disease, for example, those that have a mutation in a historic and classic pathway resistance, something called P53, which is a tumor suppressor gene. When a tumor suppressor is not active, the cancer is often more aggressive, and in CLL, that's definitely the case. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma as well, where many decades ago it was shown that one disease can look the same in the clinic. A person may have the same symptoms and the same changes on a scan, but at the molecular level, it can be quite different, and different signatures and different profiles can be found. And clearly, we've looked at non-Hodgkin's lymphoma as a disease we need to treat differently depending on the risk profile that we see at a molecular level, with certain genes being crucial to chemotherapy resistance and risk of relapse. So the story in CML, to close, was one of clear benefit, and I think it's driven advances in other myeloproliferative disorders, including the JAK2 discovery, and really further characterization of myeloproliferative disorders and the development of other targeted therapies there, and it's really led to a revolution and a better understanding of hematologic cancer. So personalized care for people living with blood cancers is a reality and something that's advancing quite nicely. Lastly, I was asked to speak about communicating with your healthcare team and about clinical trials, and I just have a few key things to say about that. The first thing is that we always, our job and as providers and on the receiving end, is that we need to have a good disease understanding, because clinical trials really, you need to take a step back to understand what's the question being asked in a trial, what are the risks and benefits, where might someone be at in their therapy, and what are the goals of a trial. But having a good disease understanding and context for where someone is the first step, and that relies on good communication between provider and patient. And next point I'd like to make is that we need to ask. Ask in the clinic. Ask on the Internet with the right information tools out there. There are the clinicaltrials.gov is a government-mandated reservoir for clinical trials in cancers of any type, where someone can look and seek and may not be exactly be able to pin down what's best for them or what's available to them, but gives someone an idea about some of the things they should be asking about, and it's our job as providers to help you with that. Our best advances are going to come through clinical trial enrollment, and I think asking is the most important question, and it's often not brought up. Is there a clinical trial option? Of course, the excellent support groups we have, like Cancer Care, Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, and other advocacy groups, clearly are there to help us navigate clinical trial options, in addition to just coping with cancer and managing even standard treatment options, of course. I'd like to, and perhaps lastly, we need to be willing to consider a clinical trial, and that's the sort of the, have a good disease understanding, ask, and then be willing. And I think what's happening increasingly is that clinical trials have changed quite a bit. We enter into clinical trials with much more knowledge about what a medication can offer, what side effects might we be able to predict, and we've actually seen medications go from their first clinical trial, which is called a phase 1 trial, right to FDA approval, which means our process has changed. We're learning things much faster, and drugs are often now receiving what's called breakthrough status, where they're able to, particularly in these small niches around this conference today about targeted therapy, where with this change in the face of clinical trials, it's a much different ballgame out there. So that is something to consider. That it's not like it used to be, where there was phase 1, phase 2, phase 3. maybe little chance of benefit. There are limitations of clinical trials, especially early clinical trials, but they've changed quite a bit. So with that, I'd like to close and just encourage everyone to keep that open dialogue with their healthcare team and to thank you for your attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Morrow, and that was really, really quite wonderful. And actually, and your call out also to clinical trials and its importance. And actually, just repeat the National Cancer Institute website is www.clinicaltrials.gov. Or you also can go to www.cancer.gov as well. A wonderful way for you to get information. And now our next speaker is Sarah Kelly, and Ms. Kelly is a coordinator of older adult services at Cancer Care, and Ms. Kelly is going to address the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care and the role of support groups.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I'd actually like to thank everyone on the call. I think we got so much good information today. As Dr. Messner said, I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and I work with many people, patients, caregivers, who are concerned with targeted therapies, diagnostic technologies, and, you know, a lot of what we've been talking about today is how to manage your care and quality of life, which I know every speaker spoke about, and Dr. Reddy certainly talked about quality of life issues. And I'd like to talk about Cancer Care's role in helping being part of a support network, which is also part of your care and part of your quality of life. So just to start out a little bit about Cancer Care and who we are, we're a national nonprofit organization. We provide free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling. We do that face-to-face in the New York area and then also over the phone nationally. We have support groups that we do face-to-face in the New York area. We also do those on the phone nationally as well as online nationally and internationally. We have education programs, such as the one we're on today. We provide practical help, help you navigate the healthcare system. We also have some limited financial assistance, as well as some chemotherapy copay assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers, and they are completely free of charge. And an oncology social worker really is trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and affects his family or friends, really the support network. We're also trained to help cancer patients and their supports tackle the problems that accompany the disease. You know, today we were talking about quality of life, communication with healthcare team. We also talk about financial demands, physical changes, social adjustments, psychological impact and care. I think adjusting to and finding ways of coping with a diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. You know, as many of you know, cancer affects not just the physical aspect, but also the whole person and the entire support network. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. You know, I think one of the things I'd like for you all to take home with you is you don't have to do this alone. In joining a support group, you can connect with others who are going through a similar situation. With individual counseling, you really have a space that's just yours to voice any concerns. And I feel these connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. I feel that if you are feeling better emotionally, it really helps you better deal with the diagnosis and also treatment concerns. At this time, we actually are gearing up for our fall term in terms of groups. So we've got online support groups. We have them for patients, caregivers. We also have telephone support groups and face-to-face support groups also for patients and caregivers, as well as provide those individual counseling services. So if you are interested in any of those services, please contact us on our HOPE line, and that's 1-800-813-HOPE or 1-800-813-4673. You can also find all of our resources on our website. We have a very comprehensive website, and that's www.cancercare.org. There's a lot of information on there as well. So if you are interested in any of our services, if you have questions about today's call, you know, we're here. I think Dr. Chris really in the beginning sort of brought it about when he talked about the evolving field and the changing landscape. We can help you as you try to navigate this changing landscape. you know, I think we learned a lot from today's program. There's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. Know that we're here for you and can help you understand what it means for you and your support network. And really, again, remembering that you're not alone in this. Cancer Care Services, we're here to help you. Thanks so much for your attention and the opportunity to talk today.
Oh, thanks so much, Sarah. That was really very informative and very lots of resources for people to access for free at Cancer Care. Thank you. And now we have time for questions, and I'm going to ask Kate to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to Kate will explain to you how to queue up for questions. We'll try to take as many of your questions as possible, and I just want to say if we don't get to your question, please call us at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, and I'll repeat that number again at the end, but why don't we see how many of your questions we can take. Kate?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from the line of Emil F. Your line is open.
Okay,
hi,
two questions. Hi. Why is prostate cancer identified differently from other cancers with the Gleason scores, and how is male breast cancer diagnosed?
Okay, well, those are excellent questions. Dr. Ruddy, do you want to take the male breast cancer question first?
Yes, I'd love to speak about male breast cancer. This is a very important and overlooked issue. Men, approximately 1% of all breast cancers are diagnosed in men, but many of these cancers are actually diagnosed at a higher stage, meaning that they've had a chance to grow larger and more chance to spread to lymph nodes under the arm than cancers that we detect in women. And part of this is because men aren't undergoing routine mammograms, so we're not finding these very small. So usually detection of breast cancer, most men actually find their own breast lumps and then bring these to the attention of their physician. Some men are detected when a physician detects a lump, but examination of breast tissue in men is not as routine as it is in women. So really most men are, the diagnosis in most cases is based on a man feeling a lump in the shower or otherwise just detecting a lump. Now in terms of the technologies that we use to treat, to decide how to treat men with breast cancer, these are pretty comparable to women. We have not yet successfully run a clinical trial that is focused specifically on male breast cancer, and so we're left extrapolating our diagnostic tools and our treatments from clinical trials that have been focused mostly on women. So we do the same kind of estrogen and progesterone receptor testing in men. We do the HER2-new testing. We do apply, at least I do in clinic, sometimes use the same tools, the Adjuvant Online and the Oncotype DX testing that I spoke about for breast cancer overall. I do use those in men with the caveat that these have not been specifically tested in men, and so particularly for the Oncotype DX, we don't fully know whether the results are mean the same thing in men as they do in women.
Excellent. Thank you.
I'm willing to jump in on the prostate.
Thank you.
A couple things about prostate cancer. It's, you know, each cancer sort of has its own character. You know, ultimately it's based on its own biology. And one thing that urologists and medical oncologists and radiation oncologists have figured out is that by, you know, looking at prostate cancers, they can make very, very good predictions about outcome. And use that to recommend surgeries and the like. And the proof is in the pudding. You know, the vast majority of men with prostate cancer discovered based on things like and categorized by things like the Gleason score are cured. The second thing that happened, to bring it back to our overall topic, is that some of the same people that were the leaders in the CML research, and I'll pick on Charles Sawyers, has now devoted his attention to prostate cancer. And it, too, is right in the middle of this molecular transformation, and many, many new drugs are being approved for the treatment of prostate cancer that cannot be cured by surgery or radiation. So I think that it's an example of how extraordinarily successful our traditional methods are, our traditional treatments, and now taking a next step with molecular characterization.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And our next question?
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question at this time, please press star, then the number one key on your touchtone telephone.
And we have a question from one of our online participants, from Sandra. Given that cancer can mutate when metastasizing to different organs, how often would one get a tissue biopsy when living with stage 4 disease? Dr. Benson, could you address that question?
Well, currently, For the most part, patients would not have subsequent tumor biopsies unless, for example, there was a particular clinical trial that required it, or between the physician and the patient looking at new options, consider some of the testing through these various diagnostic companies looking for specific mutations or other biological characteristics which might be linked to a clinical trial. Otherwise, it wouldn't be standard of care for most diseases to do multiple biopsies. It is, as mentioned, a concern that tumors mutate and change over time, and in the future, that might be something we will have to routinely do in order to make treatment decisions. But currently, for most people, it wouldn't be standard.
There have been some studies in lung cancers along these lines. You know, lung cancers, melanomas, there are literally hundreds of mutations in those tumors. But one thing that they have discovered is that, I think Dr. Morrow highlighted that term of driver mutation. These driver mutations and driver abnormalities are absolutely essential to the life of the cancer cell. So if you take a piece of cancer from a tissue, you find those drivers in virtually all the cells. And if you take the metastases in lung cancer in particular, those metastases still have the same driver mutations. Now, other mutations may change, but they're not necessarily the ones driving. You know, the term that's out there is passenger mutations. So by and large, it's very, very true. There is a need for a second biopsy, however, in lung cancer in particular, and that is under the effects of therapy, and we learned this from our colleagues in chronic myelogenous leukemia that Dr. Morrow was referring to, under the stress to the cancer cell, as it were, of these targeted therapies, they develop a second mutation in the same gene. And by finding that second mutation, you can develop another treatment for that second mutation. And that's exactly what's happened in the lung cancer area. There's now a whole third generation of drugs that are being used to target these second mutations. And why this happened and why it happened so quickly, it was understanding the biology. Based on what people learned in CML, we knew where to look, where in that kinase domain these mutations were likely to be. Sure enough, they were there. We had technology to detect them, and within literally a matter of months to years, new drugs could come up. So it's an amazing story, but it's all based ultimately on our understanding of biology.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question from one of our online participants, from Glenn. I'm interested in information on how this applies to multiple myeloma. And Dr. Morrow, could you address that question in a general way?
Sure. So multiple myeloma is a disease that sort of straddles the fence between some of the lower grade and the higher grade lymphoid cancers. And I think some of the same genetics that we've seen be developed in CLL and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma with regards to understanding what mutations are higher risk at presentation, what targets or what genes are activated, there's significant overlap. So the good news is that myeloma has really been able to benefit from exploration into different types of treatment that often are just what we're looking for, lower risk and higher benefit. The advances in myeloma also include, more extreme treatments like allogeneic stem cell transplantation, but in general, I would say that it follows the same pattern as CLL and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, where we not only have the genetics and the pathways, for example, in the B cell receptor genes, we have other targets that are relevant, and newer therapies, I think, still in development. Myeloma had a bit of push in development in a few years back, and I think we've seen a little bit more of a surge with CLL. But stay tuned, because I think there's going to be a lot of crosstalk and overlap between all of those diseases.
Excellent. Thank you. Another question from one of our online participants is, what are the side effects of targeted therapy drugs? Dr. Benson, could you address that?
Well, they vary with a particular agent. certainly in the world of GI oncology, targeted agents can have significant toxicities, including changes in the skin, as well as the hands and feet, nails, for example. And for many of these drugs, even those that come in pill form, we require careful monitoring. And for some of these agents, we're actually seeing patients on a weekly basis so that we have confidence that there's good tolerance and we can adjust the dose as needed. But they vary. There are many different targeted agents now, and for each one, there may be specific toxicities that are relative. And it is important whenever a patient begins any new drug, but certainly the targeted agents, that there's a clear understanding of what risks may be and what needs to be monitored over time.
Well, thank you. And we have a question about what are nuclear medicine scans. I've read that nuclear medicine scans fall under diagnostic tests. Dr. Roddy, would you like to address that?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question?
What are nuclear medicine scans? I've read that nuclear medicine scans fall under diagnostic tests.
So in breast cancer, we sometimes use nuclear medicine scans to assess for whether or not cancer has spread elsewhere in the body. So there's a test called a bone scan that falls under this category, where a dye that has nuclear radioactivity is injected, and then we can see whether the bones show any evidence of the cancer having gone to that area. There are other nuclear medicine tests as well that can help with imaging different parts of the body. The requirement, those tests don't tend to be so much tests that we would use to assess for response to treatment in the early stage setting, but certainly nuclear medicine studies are a type of imaging that we use in various settings.
Thank you. Thank you. I really want to thank all of our speakers. This has been an extraordinary call, and we had an extraordinary team of speakers today. Thank you all. And we also also want to thank all of you who've been listening to the call and who have asked great questions both on the phone and online and who've been listening as well. And I do want to remind you that there is a part two to this program, understanding the role of biomarkers in the care and treatment of people living with cancer. So please stay tuned. It's on Friday, October 10th. So we hope that you'll stay tuned for the second part of this, because these are very important new treatment approaches and that it's really important you're going to hear more and more about them. I also want to remind all of you that you did get materials from Cancer Care, and there is an evaluation form in those materials, and we so appreciate your taking a moment at the end of the program and completing your evaluation form and sending it back to us. We very much depend upon your feedback to tell us the programs you'd like us to offer going forward, what was helpful about the program today. So tell us what you'd like us to offer. We're planning lots of programs for this year and into next year as well, so the timing could not be better for you to tell us what you'd like us to offer. Also, most importantly, as we're about to conclude the program, as Sarah Kelly had said, we don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with cancer. The program itself, the workshop, may be soon ending, but the help that you can access from Cancer Care, that goes on endlessly. And you have our 800 number, 1-800-813-HOPE. If you have a question you didn't get to ask, please call our staff. If you need help with a practical or financial matter, or if you need to talk with someone in terms of counseling or support or a support group, or you'd like to sign up for another workshop, all of those things are available. We also have wonderful publications and website. They're all there for you, and they are simply a telephone call, or you can email us as well at CancerCare as well for help. So we, most importantly, as we're about to conclude, I wouldn't want anyone to think they're alone, that we are here to help you. And I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.